You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Alex Shakar's first novel, The Savage Girl, was published just a week after the September 11th attacks, and despite early rave reviews, it immediately became, in the words of one critic, a relic of the recent past. His second novel, Luminarium, has just been published by Soho Press, and it's set in New York City 5 years after the events of 2001. Publishers Weekly has called it a penetrating look at the uneasy intersection of technology and spirituality. And I'm pleased that it brings Mr. Shakar, who's a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Great. Thanks.
You recently wrote an essay for the online literary magazine, The Millions, that details the extraordinary circumstances surrounding the publication of The Savage Girl. You want to go through it, or should I just lay it out? No, you do it.
it was a tumultuous experience in a lot of ways.
There was this bidding war, so you must have thought, "Wow, I've hit the jackpot."
Yes, it was a real roller coaster. I had a tremendous experience all the way through it, leading right up to publication. Everything seemed to be building in a great way, and
rave reviews. It was published September 18th. Published on schedule?
Yes.
And it was also named a New York Times Notable Book of 2001.
Yes.
Is it a coincidence that Luminarium is being published around the 10th anniversary of the attacks?
Well, it's serendipitous. I'll put it that way. I would have loved to have it finished earlier, but it just simply took this long.
It's taken you 10 years to write this book?
Yes.
I'm just wondering whether you're dangerous. This book is coming out during a time when the East Coast has just endured a horrific hurricane, and not long after experiencing an earthquake.
Yeah, luckily the hurricane was merciful to us this time, so and to me.
Luminarium is set in New York City in 2006. Why did you choose that particular year?
When I just started writing the book, I was thinking about setting it right after the attacks, and it was just too soon and too close. And as time went on, I became more and more interested in how the narratives that were going on in people's heads, all the reactions to 9/11, and the ways that people were making meaning out of it and making narratives out of it, and adapting and positioning themselves, and that really, you know, the 9/11 novel became something of a de rigueur kind of thing to do, and so I make fun of that a little bit in the book, but it was also deeply meaningful to me, and so I was trying to figure out a way of showing that date was a time when the event was just passing into history and in some ways into myth.
Because life had returned to normal for most people, but at the same time, everybody felt that it had been altered forever.
Yes, yes.
The Savage Girl was a satirical look at marketing and consumerism. This novel's plot involves the intersection of technology and spirituality. What got you interested in that particular theme?
Well, originally I had read an article about a Canadian researcher who had invented a helmet that gives people sensed presence experiences. And that immediately, you know, I just got this image of a guy who lost everything, and he was practically homeless and out on the street, and yet his eyes were luminous and something had happened to him. And then 9/11 happened, and it affected me personally, you know, in my very small way. I saw it, how it affected people around me.
Wait, so the seed of this actually precedes 9/11? Precedes the publication of the first book?
Yes, it was one idea among others that I wasn't really, you know, pursuing. And then 9/11 happened, and I zeroed in on this. There were sort of a number of things that happened after 9/11, including, you know, personal experiences for me, but also things that were happening to my family members, friends of mine. I saw my mother as a Reiki healer, and I saw her going to work with her group on the recovery workers and the medical examiners and the families and in the relief tents, and then a friend of mine had a software company, which was before 9/11 it was a startup, and they had been geared toward designing a virtual world for children, and it was this cartoony, idealistic kind of place. And then after 9/11, they followed the gold rush of war dollars down to the military entertainment complex, the software guys were calling it, and and overnight, their virtual world was transformed into a training ground for the Army.
So you've drawn on all of these things for this book. Your protagonist, Fred Bernian, is the former co-CEO of a software company that is devoted to creating utopian virtual worlds. And then it gets his the book gets – I mean, the company gets sold to the military.
Yes, it gets sold to a military contractor.
Now, why would military contractors want a company of this sort to simulate combat scenarios?
Yes, yes. Soldiers can train over broad distances. They can go over and over different scenarios for training, both in terms of peacekeeping operations, in terms of there are actors who can play. Who can play warlords, and they can play, you know, different kinds of civilians and terrorists.
And did that happen with the person you knew?
Yes, yes.
Also, well, Fred is broke, and he's moved back in with his parents, who sound a lot like your parents.
An actor
and a Reiki practitioner.
You could have made her
into some other kind of practitioner.
Well, yeah.
How do your parents feel about the characters you've created here?
Thankfully for me, they're enormously excited about it. My father's used to a certain amount of this kind of thing, being an actor, and so he and I would have a lot of talks about his art and my art and how to get into the moment and how to pursue a story.
Fred and his father have a magic act that they perform at children's parties.
Yes.
You ever do that?
As a kid, I did it, yes.
Now, Fred has a twin brother named George, who's his partner in the company that they sell. He's now in hospital in a coma, dying of cancer. Do you have a twin brother?
No. No. George was... actually, he came very late in my process of writing the book. I was struggling for a long time to try to find what really was powering Fred on this journey. What was motivating him to take this leap into this crazy journey that he goes on, and
which is signing up for a research study at NYU.
Yes,
and he wears that helmet that you were talking about.
Yes,
it sends impulses to his brain with the goal of reproducing the peak experiences commonly associated with spiritual awakening.
Yes. Yes. So he'll have they give him a little bit of a different experience every week. You know, the first week he has a oneness kind of experience, so he becomes one with his chair, and then the after effects linger as he goes out onto the street in sometimes humorous and disastrous ways, but also in compelling ways for him.
Did the original experiment, the one that you talked about, which... was looking for sensed prescience experiences. Did that have a similar effect?
That was one out of a number of effects that my helmet does. So, mm-hmm. I took a few liberties, but a number of these things that I'm talking about are now to some degree reproducible in laboratory experiences in various ways, including out of body experiences.
Because they're stimulating certain parts of the brain.
They work in different ways, but yeah.
Now, why would Fred want to participate in a study like this?
Well, okay. So Fred, as you mentioned, Fred's twin brother George is dying in a cancer-induced coma in the hospital, and Fred still haunts Fred in a number of ways, but Fred still talks to him in his head all the time, and their company, which they founded, has been more or less stolen from them, and he's broke, and his fiance has left him, and so he is he's kind of just desperate, and he sees this flyer, and it also there's sort of a coincidence where he sees that she carries a briefcase that looks a lot like his and George's, so he signs up for this study, and then So I think he's got several different motivations, yeah.
He begins receiving emails from George with the subject line, "Help Avatara."
Yes. Yes, so he's haunted in more ways than
one. Does he really believe these messages are from his twin?
No.
They're telepathic.
No, as most of us would, he assumes that it's got to be some kind of prank.
After beginning his stint as a research subject, Fred finds himself spontaneously merging with random people. Is it a side effect of the sessions with the God Helmet?
Yes. So he merges with all kinds of things. He merges with toilet seats. He merges with random people on the street that he ends up following, and that they lead him into very uncomfortable situations. And he merges with his experimenter, and that's the start of a sense of a very deep connection with her that then gets pursued.
Well, Mira Eckhart is the woman conducting the research. He's, as you said, he's broken with his fiancée. But this sounds like empathy gone wild.
Well, in a way,
we all want to be empathetic.
In a way, yes, but in a way, it's also something he needs. It's the start of something that once he pursues it to the end, it takes him to interesting places.
I understand that you took up Zen meditation while you're writing the book as a form of research, or because you genuinely felt drawn to the practice.
It was both. It was both. I had been doing a lot of research, and I couldn't get beneath the surface. Really, I couldn't. You know, there was some way I wanted to experience for myself something of what was happening with Fred in the helmet, and for a long time I couldn't. And I was doing a lot of reading and getting more and more interested in the writings of mystics and contemplative contemplatives. So I went to a Zendo, and also, you know, the book had, you know, some personal origins for me in a lot of ways that we've discussed. So I was angry a little bit at organized religion or at some parts of it, but at the same time, materialism wasn't quite cutting it for me at the deepest level. So I went in there and I asked them for some kind of answers, and instead of giving me answers, they sat me down and taught me how to breathe and how to sit, and those were two things I had thought that I knew how to do.
But you're also exploring the difference between reality and unreality in this book, and isn't that what writers do?
Yes. The epigraph is "Lead me from the unreal to the real." That's from an Upanishad, and the meaning of unreal and the meaning of real change for me in interesting ways over the course of this story, and that's the meaning of a lot of things sort of change for Fred as he goes through the story. The meaning of faith, the meaning of ignorance, the meaning of the military entertainment complex, what that means. It takes on inner significances and over time.
The reviews have been great. Are you hoping that it'll also get people to take another look at your first novel, The Savage Girl, or is that past you?
Well, that would be nice. Right now I'm focused on this one.
Yeah. Well, this Savage Girl just had so much bad karma. I hate to use the word karma, but we're in that mindset. Your editor, Robert Jones, died of cancer just before September 11th, right before the book was published. Your agent, Bill Clegg, has written a memoir about being addicted to crack at the time.
Yes.
Did all of that affect you? Did that have some kind of effect on the way you approach this book?
Yes, it did. Pretty soon after the book, after The Savage Girl came out, I found myself on my own again. I was working with Bill a little bit on very early just chapters of the book, and he was encouraging me to continue. And Robert was gone, and I think there was a little bit of George that came from Robert, So when Bill left the land of the living for a while, I was on my own for a while, and I was it was a journey through with a lot of ups and downs. Yeah.
Where does the title Luminarium come from?
Well, it's the Latin word for light. It's the name, as you find out later on in the book, it's the name of this equipment. I was struggling trying to find the right title for the book, and I went to see the psychic, and this was a couple years ago, I was just at loose ends because I had written a version of the book and this was 2007 and it didn't sell, and that's when I found my way back to Bill and I just needed to know whether I was a writer, you know,
Well, you're teaching writing, so you have to at least your students have to believe you're a writer.
Yeah, well, I was having such great experiences with the book, but you know, I knew that there was something in it. But anyway, so I saw this psychic and asked her, is this actually going to happen? And she says, oh yeah, don't worry, it's going to be another 9 months, another year, it's going to work out fine. Whatever, you know, it helped me to hear that. Whatever, you know, whatever you want to think about that. And I asked her about the title, and she said, it's going to be the world as seen. It's going to be, you know, I can't tell you exactly, but it's going to be the world as seen through the helmet. And I think that's really what Luminarium is.
Alex Shakar's first novel, The Savage Girl, was selected as a New York Times notable book. It's been translated into 6 languages. He's also published a short story collection called City in Love. And now there is Luminarium, which is published by Soho Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much.